out of left Youngstown, Ohio. Guys in the neighborhood have nicknames. He's an old country boy around New York, Newark, and those big cities. So I had to try to fit in. I think being cool might work.
And cool with a K, not with a C.
With a K, right.
Cool with a K. Of Cool and the Gang is here to help us celebrate later on in the show. But first. Bruce Springsteen is pretty much the all-American man. The blue jeans, the sweaty marathon concerts, guitar duels. Well, the Boss also has a huge fan base in the LGBTQ community, especially with lesbians. Writer Naomi Gordon Lobel wrote about the singer's queer appeal in The Nation. I spoke with her a few months ago. Well, first of all, let's get this out of the way. You're not saying that Springsteen himself is gay, right? Because he's been married to a woman for nearly 30 years, etc.
Right, exactly. That's a very important distinction. I'm not saying that he's queer. I don't think he is, although I guess you never know.
You never know. But anyway, you're not saying that in your essay. You're basically saying that he has an appeal to the LGBTQ community. And what is that based on?
There are themes in his music that really evoke some experiences of being queer and that really speak to what it is like to be queer. I think some of those themes have to do with masculinity and a complicated relationship to masculinity and sort of a recognition of it as a construct. Some of them have to do with really acknowledging the less than perfect nature of love and also like a vision of love that involves sacrifice and that a kind of desire that is often punished. And then also, most importantly, a lot of his music really speaks to this like twin sense of longing and also alienation, a sense of wanting something and a really intense desire, but also feeling so isolated and so alone. And I think that is a feeling that a lot of queer people, although not all queer people, but a lot of us can really relate to.
Okay, let's play some music that may illustrate what you're talking about. This one is Darkness on the Edge of Town. So I guess it's that last line, for wanting things that can only be found in the darkness on the edge of town, that is speaking to what you're talking about?
Yeah, man, I love that verse. I think it's so emblematic of the queerness of Bruce. The whole song is kind of talking about how he's sort of fed up with this sense of alienation that he's been feeling. And then, of course, there's all this like beautiful, the fact that it's literally the darkness on the edge of town. And we think of like for so many decades, queerness has been forced to exist in these liminal spaces, literally often in the darkness and on the edges of towns, that it's really remarkable. It really speaks to the sort of like existence on the margins, you know, and this like desire for something on the margins. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, in your essay, you also talk about your personal experience coming of age and some of the scary experiences that you've had, which call to mind this very idea of trying to live your life on the edges. And I wonder if you could talk about one incident that you write about where you are with your girlfriend and this is in college and a bunch of frat boys come up to you.
Man, we had just gotten together like a couple months before and we were totally in that blissful stage that I think any young relationship is in, of just being totally obsessed with each other and everything kind of feels amazing. And we were sitting on the steps outside of our dorm, like laughing and being together. And then this car full of frat boys, or what I read as frat boys, drove up and pulled up to the curb. And they had some kind of crazy bright flashlight with them because they shined it like directly in our eyes so we couldn't see them. And then they just started harassing us and taunting us and saying, you know, like, she doesn't want you, she wants a real man, or she needs a real man, like, come over here and we'll show you what a real man can do. It was awful. It was so terrifying. We didn't know if they were gonna get out of the car. And also, Just that harassment just like kind of instantly makes you feel both fear and also shame, and such a jarring sense of kind of like there being something fundamentally either wrong with you or like unsafe about you being in the world. And obviously it totally ruined our night, but it also bonded us in a particular way in that it connected us. We'd had this scary experience, and we also knew that neither of us was going to walk away from each other in that moment. We would never abandon each other in the face of that kind of threat. And that is a really intense kind of intimacy. And I think beauty, like it's a showing of like, I can and will and want to be strong for you and for us. And like, we're going to face really scary things, and we're going to like hold each other through them and protect each other.
And yeah. So bring it back to the Springsteen thesis. Is there a song that really speaks to that particular experience that you've had?
Yeah, Tougher Than the Rest, I think, is such a beautiful queer adjacent, or a song that evokes queerness in its words. Yeah, I think that song is kind of a perfect emblem for that.
Your road is dark, and it's a thin, thin line, but I want you to know I'll walk it for you anytime. Maybe couldn't pass the test, but if you're then ready for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest.
Well, he's talking about a heterosexual relationship there, right? And he's wanting to be the better boyfriend to this woman. But it still speaks to you and your experience.
First of all, yes, absolutely. The verse before that, he's naming all these men's names, and he's saying, you know, some girls, they want a handsome Dan or a good looking Joe. And he's saying he's not any of those things. And I'm obviously not either. but yeah, I think that line, the road is dark and it's a thin, thin line, but I want you to know I'd walk it for you anytime. I wrote in the piece, I feel like queer couples are in some ways always saying that to each other. I think it's really true. It's saying, I know it's not going to be easy, and there are scary things out there, and our relationship is always, in some sense, going to have this threat of violence or of hatred anyway, hanging over it, but I'm going to walk with you through that. I think it's really powerful.
Do you think that his music speaks more to queer women than to queer men?
It's interesting you should ask that. I really feel like I'm sort of most intimately familiar with the way that his music speaks to queer women. And of course, there is a component here, which is that he is very often singing to and about a lover who is a woman or a girlfriend. And so that's obviously something that I can relate to. I'm a person who has girlfriends and lovers who are women. But after I wrote this piece, I heard from a lot of queer men, gay men, who had a totally different sort of take on how they related to him. Somebody actually wrote to me and told me that, which I had not known this, that Armistead Maupin, who's this sort of iconic gay author, had written in one of his books that every generation has an artist who straight men feel like they have permission to be attracted to, and that Bruce Springsteen is that man for our generation, or for the probably the generation before mine. So I do think that there's a totally different maybe appeal that he has to gay men, or maybe it has some overlap, but there's also an angle that is more about attraction to him rather than necessarily like identification with his desire for women.
Right. Yeah. Cause he's pretty attractive to everybody.
He is pretty attractive. Totally. To everybody. Who could blame anyone for being attracted to Bruce Springsteen?
Well, also his look. I mean, it's almost an iconic gay male look, right? With the bandana and the tight jeans and the white t-shirt.
Exactly. So I had a lot of fun when I was writing this essay, and I started realizing just how much he looks like he's straight out of the Castro in the 80s. Like, you know, there's that very famous album cover where he's wearing blue jeans and he's got a bandana hanging out of his pocket and a white t-shirt, and the cover is of his butt. And it's like an iconic butch look. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense that queer people would go crazy for him.
But on top of all that, he actually has reached out to the gay community, right? I mean, he was one of the first rock and roll artists to feature a gay couple in a music video, right?
Yeah, in Tougher Than the Rest, which is the song we were just talking about, there's at least one, maybe a number of queer couples in that video, yeah.
And so what has he said about his appeal to the queer community?
He hasn't said that much. I think it's really remarkable that he was interviewed by The Advocate, which is sort of like preeminent LGBTQ magazine in the 90s. And it's a really beautiful interview, actually, and I encourage people to check it out. He talks a lot about how he always felt like a misfit. He describes himself as like a town freak, and that in that for that reason, he never really bought into the sort of like mainstream homophobia around him. And also that he could relate to feeling like an outcast. And he talks about his dad really always kind of rejecting him because he was gentle and sensitive and artistic. And then finally, yeah, the interviewer asked him about how he would react if his kid came out to him. And he says he would be supportive and that he thinks kind of the most important thing is about being able to be yourself and that he understands how painful it is to not be able to be yourself. It was really gratifying to me to read that, which came out in 1996. We're talking about a long time ago, and not in any way to paint him as some kind of LGBTQ hero. I think it's really important to say that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think he's a gay hero. I don't know it, like how far his allyship extends. And it's really not about that to me. But definitely that interview shows that he was at least sort of aware of queer folks and some of the challenges that queer people face.
Well, let me just ask you, because a lot of rock stars, they're artists and they come from troubled families, perhaps fathers who didn't understand them. They write about freedom and hitting the open road. They wear sexy clothes and look, you know, hyper masculine. So what is it about Bruce Springsteen compared to all these other rock stars who may share similar characteristics?
There's certainly something about rock and roll in general. Like, rock and roll is a kind of music that's often speaking about anguish. And so in that way, anguish is something that is a pretty human experience, pretty universal, but also obviously like can be slotted in similar ways to queerness. But I think it's sort of the combination of these things, I would say. It's not any one thing. It's his butchness, his sort of like butch iconic aesthetic. It's this music about, in particular, love and romance that is really hard. And it's sort of ironic when he talks about how he's not kind of the world's best romantic. Like, a lot of lines in his songs are kind of about, hey, like, you're not perfect, I'm not perfect, but we're all right and we're going to make it work. And that's a little different than like all rock and roll artists. And then, yeah, I think mostly I would say while a lot of artists have attempted it, I'm not sure anybody really speaks as profoundly and as specifically to this kind of combined feeling of desire and also loneliness and a sense of like really deep alienation combined with also hope. And I think that in a way, the fact that he's nailed that so perfectly, that duality, is probably what accounts for his widespread success in general.
Okay, let's end on the one that he usually ends on in his concerts. And this is called, of course, Born to Run. And I want you to set it up for us and we'll go out on it. And tell us why this one is particularly important to you as a queer woman.
I think that this song is all about both acknowledging kind of the cages that might surround us, the feeling of hopelessness at times, like the sense of a place that is not enough, that like can't really allow us to be our full selves, but also a song that is full of possibility and hope and determination and the sense that, no, there is a beyond.
Okay, Born to Run. Naomi Gordon-Lobo, she's a fellow at the Type Media Center, and you can read her article about the queerness of Bruce Springsteen at thenation.com. Naomi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Miles Davis was the Prince of Darkness and the King of Cool. We'll explore his life and career and hear some of that iconic trumpet next on Press Play. This is Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Madeline Brand. Miles Davis. He changed as much as his sound. Kind of Blue, Sketches of Spain, Bitches Brew. But even as he struggled with relationships, addiction, and his health, Miles Davis's music was a soundtrack for the Black experience in America. Director Stanley Nelson's new documentary, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, uses never-before-seen footage, some studio outtakes, and rare photos of Miles to tell his life story. And we're joined now by Stanley Nelson. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, you've made lots of documentaries. You've made documentaries about the Black Panthers, about Black colleges in America, Jonestown, Marcus Garvey, etc. What got you interested in making a movie about Miles?
Well, I'm a real music lover, a real jazz lover, and, you know, who's better than Miles Davis to make a movie about? You know, not only is he a great musician who changed the course of jazz and also the course of music several times in his lifetime, but also he's such an interesting individual, you know. It's he's a very complicated man, and so I think a complicated man makes or a complicated individual makes a more complicated film.
How did he become such a virtuoso trumpet player?
You know, Miles is an interesting guy. You know, he's given a trumpet when he's in grade school, and he's immediately just takes to it. You know, he's a genius, you know, at a young age. You know, but also, you know, Miles had two jobs in his life. He had a paper route for, you know, a couple of weeks as a kid, and he was a musician. So Miles, you know, because his family had some wealth, Miles was able to just play and practice and play. He then gets a job with a local group in St. Louis, in East St. Louis. And, you know, he's 14, and this is a group of men. And you know, we have pictures of him on the bandstand where, you know, he looks like a little kid. But what happens is because the other musicians have day jobs, you know, they all have to have day jobs, Miles becomes kind of the band leader, you know, in some ways, and you know, does the bookings and the books and becomes really great. At leading these small groups. And, you know, some people say, you know, he might have been the greatest small group manager, you know, ever.
And that's where he met Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker?
Yeah, he's playing in East St. Louis, and Dizzy and Charlie come through with a group, and they need a trumpet player, a second trumpet player to sit in. And so Miles gets to sit in. He's still in high school. And he just, you know, realizes that's his future. And, you know, when he gets out of high school, he gets on a train to New York. But, you know, his parents didn't want him to do that, especially his mother. So he enrolls in Juilliard. So he goes to New York for two things. One, to be a student at Juilliard, but also to find and play with Charlie Parker.
You have an actor reading parts of his autobiography throughout the movie, and I just want to play a clip of that when he's talking about that summer when he played with Dizzy and Bird.
The greatest feeling I ever had in my life with my clothes on was when I first met Dizzy and Bird. I was 18 years old. I decided right then and there I had to be in New York on 52nd Street where the action was.
Okay, we should address the issue of his voice. That, as again, that's an actor playing Miles Davis, but he had a famously raspy voice. How did he get that raspy voice?
Okay, so Miles, I think it was around 1956, he had throat polyps, and he had an operation to remove these polyps. It, you know, a pretty simple operation, but he was told, you know, that he could not speak or raise his voice for 2 weeks. And Miles gets mad at somebody and starts cursing him out and screaming at him. And that was it, you know, for the rest of his life. His voice was like that, you know, and it became Miles's signature.
It definitely feeds into the whole mystique of Miles Davis, which is quite a mystique. It's not just the music, although the music is just something else. It's also his look and his cool, right?
Yeah, I mean, Miles is just a fantastic character. As one person said to us, you know, they had never seen a man who was as beautiful as Miles when he was young. And, you know, Miles was very, very dark-skinned, which was not the ideal at that point, you know, for among black folks. But Miles was undeniably beautiful, undeniably cool. You know, he's getting his clothes made, you know, tailor-made, you know, from the middle 50s on. He's driving, you know, Ferraris and Lamborghinis. He's named one of the best-dressed men in America in, I think it's 1958. You know, he's hanging out constantly with beautiful women, you know, and he has that voice, you know, and he's just cool. And his music also has this kind of coolness to it for much of, you know, the 50s and the 60s, where Miles, you know, decides, you know, he makes this decision that he's not going to, you know, play the trumpet, you know, in those high, you know, quick notes that you hear, you know, so often with Dizzy Gillespie or Louis Armstrong, that he's going to kind of slow it down and that the pauses are just as important as the notes that he plays.
Well, let's hear an example of that. Here's a song. Here's a bit of the song. It Never Entered My Mind. Well, that's just beautiful. And it really is romantic.
Yeah, I mean, the sequence where we use It Never Entered My Mind, where we talk about Miles's ballads, is probably, you know, at least at this point, you know, my favorite scene that I've ever worked on and edited. You know, it's just, and to me, an incredible scene where we tried to talk about the music and talk about the beauty of Miles's music. And, you know, we have great people, you know, Herbie Hancock and others, and Carlos Santana and others describe, you know, Miles's ballads and the beauty of Miles's ballads. And it's just, I think, a really wonderful sequence in the film.
How much of his music was preconceived and composed before he got members of his band together versus improvised?
You know, I think one of the things we talk about in the film is as Miles' music progresses, it becomes more and more improvised. You know, he goes to France in 56 and records a soundtrack for a film called Elevator to the Gallows. And the way they do it is they just put the film up on the screen in front of him and his band, and they play along to the film and record, you know, this incredible album that's totally improvised. You know, and I think he learned something from that. And, you know, a couple of years later, he comes back and records, you know, one of his most famous albums, Kind of Blue.
There was a dark side to Miles Davis. He was married several times and with a lot of women, many of whom say he was physically violent with them. And Frances Taylor, in particular, one of his wives, says that she was a dancer and she was cast in West Side Story. And he told her she couldn't be in it and she dropped out. I wonder if you could talk about that, his relationship with women and why he was so violent with them.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. I mean, it's hard to say definitively why somebody's like that. But one of the things I found that most telling, you know, Miles actually, from his autobiography, you know, in the film, he tells a story about how his father, he saw his mother and father have physical fights. And, you know, he says, you know, it had to affect us somehow, but I don't know how. And I think as the film goes on, you kind of see how it affected Miles, because he has very abusive relationships with women, with Frances and other women. But one of the things that's clear in the film is he really needed the women. You know, it's clear how much he needed Frances, you know, and he's heartbroken when Frances finally leaves. As someone says in the film, you know, Frances was with him for 9 years, and those years are, you know, Elevated to the Gallows, you know, Kind of Blue, the beginning of the second quintet. All that stuff comes, you know, when he's in a stable relationship with Frances.
And then he plugs in. He's influenced by the Woodstock generation. And again, a woman that he's with, Betty Mabry, right? She introduces him to that kind of music?
Yeah, Betty Mabry, who becomes Betty Davis, who's also a musician, introduces him, you know, to rock music, and Miles starts, you know, listening more and more to Jimi Hendrix and Sly and the Family Stone and James Brown, and wants to, you know, kind of change the way he's going. And so he comes out, with Bitches Brew, you know, one of the most important albums in jazz.
Okay, that's definitely a different sound.
Yeah.
Kind of Blue. Do you think that survives the test of time the way Kind of Blue does?
Yeah, in a very different way. Uh-huh. I think it does. I mean, you know, one of the things that was really interesting for us in making the film was that there's a whole generation that ties in to the Electric Miles in a way that other people tie into, you know, Kind of Blue and those albums. You know, I could say, I mean, I don't go home after a hard day and put on the Corner, you know. those albums are very challenging.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you think about, you know, Return to Forever, the Mahavishnu Orchestra, Weather Report, all these groups came out of the musicians who were playing with Miles on Bitches Brew.
Hmm. So he died fairly young, 65, in 1991, from a stroke, complications from a stroke?
Yeah, Miles, you know, died early. One of the interesting things, I know his father died at almost the same age, and I believe his grandfather also, you know, died at almost the same age.
Hmm. So not necessarily because of all the drugs that he had done in his life.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, you know, Miles had so many, you know, that illnesses that he just, you know, had throughout his life. He had sickle cell, you know, he had broken his hip a couple of times. I mean, there were a lot of things that Miles had that you know, just compiled on top of the drug use that you know, was off and on for so much of his life.
Mm-hmm. And when you came away from this, how did you feel about him as a person, not just as a musician, but as a person?
You know, I mean, Miles was a very, very challenging person. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, he's kind of an enigma. You know, one of the last lines in the film is from Frances, and, you know, she says, you know, how could a man who played such beautiful music, you know, be so rough? And then she says, you know, I don't regret, you know, but I still love. You know, all the musicians that played with Miles loved him, you know, and love him to this day. You know, there's the good and bad of Miles, and that's just the reality of who Miles was.
That's Stanley Nelson, director of Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, streaming now on Netflix. Coming up, comedian and musician Tim Heidecker on his serious side. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Comedian Tim Heidecker has made a career blurring the lines between fantasy and reality. His TV shows on Adult Swim, like Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job, and Check It Out with Dr. Steve Brule, have created a different kind of comedy, subversive, cringy, surreal, not always laugh out loud funny. Well, Tim Heidecker is also a musician, and he's put out several comedy albums in which he sings and plays piano. He's done two that parody President Trump, and that has set off Trump's defenders, his fans, who began harassing Heidecker online. Well, his response, another comedy album that takes them on. It's called What the Brokenhearted Do. And here to tell me more about it is Tim Heidecker himself.
Well,
hello.
Here to correct you, I wouldn't consider it a comedy album. It's an album. It's an album of music.
You don't think it's funny?
No.
No.
I don't.
Okay, it's just straight up.
They're songs. I mean, the origin of it, you could maybe argue is funny, and there's humor in it, but they're it's not a goof.
It is about divorce.
Yeah, breaking up. It's about loss. And you have a smile on your face because, people don't know where I'm coming from a lot of the time.
I know.
I have a variety of interests, a variety of tastes. And one of the things I love is this kind of music, the kind of music mm-hmm. I make.
And how would you describe it?
You know, it's 70s singer-songwriter, Randy Newman, Warren Zevon. Mm-hmm. Little Paul Simon maybe before he got into the world music.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's that genre, singer-songwriter.
And you did it in response, though, to this online
harassment. I did it. I would say it was inspired by, in a lot of ways, these trolls online started this rumor that my wife had left me because I was such a soy boy,
What's a soy boy?
You know what a soy boy
no,
is?
No, I don't.
It's a derogatory term for liberal men.
Oh, because you don't eat meat?
Because I do eat meat. I had a French dip for lunch, but...
I mean one who is
yeah.
not part of them.
Yeah, just
the
a beta male, not a strong American,
like
not
they
a
drink
Trump
white
supporter.
Wine, not red wine.
Exactly.
You got it.
Yeah, so that's one of their tactics, and it was sort of this idea that I'm such a liberal, I'm such like a weak man that my wife couldn't take anymore. She left.
Oh.
She left me. And they went so far as to doctor up divorce papers that they put online.
Wow.
Which I found confusing and amusing, but it did plant a seed in my brain. And I was like, these are the kind of songs I kind of write, but I never know what to do with them. Kind of country, sort of sad songs. And then this was going on. I said, well, this is not a bad direction to take a record if I was going to do another record. And what's funny is that though it's not autobiographical and I'm not talking about my own life necessarily, people that are going through this have been writing me just saying like, I'm just going through this divorce or I'm going through this breakup and this record is like hitting me hard.
So you really are serious that it's not a comedy album?
Yeah.
You understand the origins of mine and maybe perhaps
yeah,
others' confusion.
Absolutely.
Because your comedy isn't straight up like, this is funny.
Right.
Hello.
Some of it, I've spent a lot of my career, using my own name to present things that aren't necessarily about who I really am. You know, the mm-hmm. sort of the false identity. I haven't come up with a bunch of fake character names for me, so I am who I am, but... I think my audience is getting warmed up to this idea that I can do a couple different things at once.
Yeah.
So, I get it and it's fine. Everybody can take it for however they want to take it. But
you're saying that people who are going through this are really finding
they
it
are.
Helpful or I, at least they're
yeah,
speaking
it's,
to
it's
them.
Yeah, it's cathartic or mm-hmm. They're universal themes. We've all been dumped. We've all been
yeah.
gone through breakups and... You know, there's...
I mean, it's a perennial in a country western song, right?
Yeah, the secret is they're easy songs to write, you know? So I go for the shortcuts, you know, subject-wise.
Like, give me an example.
You can repeat yourself over and over again, so you don't have to write a whole lot of lyrics,
right.
You know? So one song is, I don't think about her much anymore.
I don't think about you much anymore. Except when it's raining, oh, there's a knock on my door. I don't think about you much anymore.
So I just say that I don't think about her much anymore. I don't think about her much anymore. But as the song goes on, you're like, this guy's clearly obsessed.
Because
with
he
this.
Keeps repeating,
he keeps
right?
saying it. He's in denial about it. So, yeah, there's, you know, the song title's I'm Not Good Enough. That's tough.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel that way. But it's kind of pathetic. There's humor.
We all do,
maybe there's
don't we?
There's humor in the relentlessness of the subject. This guy that is kind of pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, failure is funny oftentimes.
Well, you can look at it that way, yeah. or you can look at it in a tragic way. Speaking of, let's play a song from your Trump parody album that maybe set some of these people off. It's called Ballad of the Incel.
Got my picture of Obama, which will burn in effigy. But I hope I'll find a like-minded girl tonight at the Trump rally.
Pretty music.
It is.
Listen to what's going on in the background.
He sounds like such a nice guy.
Yeah, I was looking at all these images of these rallies with these people that show up at these Trump rallies and putting myself in the head space of some guy who's going there in hopes of finding love.
Yeah. Instead of hate.
Yeah. You know, maybe I'll meet a nice girl there. I mean, it's
possible.
Like it's a big, I present it like you're
like
going,
concert.
You're going to a rock concert.
Yeah.
You're going to like a monster truck
right, why not?
Event. Yeah.
Why not?
World wrestling event.
So how did you get into the political part of all of this? Is that fairly new? Is that Trump adjacent?
Yeah. I mean, Eric and I always kind of kept it out of our work. Eric Wareheim, partner in a lot of my work, and didn't feel we were in any position to get involved. And I mean, I used to do this, I still do occasionally, but I used to do this stand-up comedian that was sort of this Tim Allen, right-wing, blowhard, you know, anti, you know, everything, but, you know, anti-PC, kind of just this guy's guy. And in 2011, I was, you know, Trump started coming up on Twitter. He started tweeting a lot and sort of inserting himself into politics. And I started doing this routine where, like, you know who should run for president is Donald Trump. Now, this guy gets it. He is the real deal. And I started doing this thing, and it was just like a joke. It was like, you know, people
were
laughing.
Do you think he was listening?
He must have been. I think he was at some of my shows in Silver Lake, you know. But it started, I guess, there. And then just on Twitter, you know, I couldn't help but react. I understand entertainers who don't want to talk about politics. I understand. But it also feels like it's very hard not to, because it just feels like you're in momentous times at the moment, you know.
Is it hard to make it funny if a lot of it you see as not funny, as pretty serious?
It is hard. And the Trump, the album called Too Dumb for Suicide, is funny to me. It's a funny idea. It's dark, very dark comedy. But there's humor on it. But I also didn't want to make it too ironic or too separated from some of the real scary sadness of it. So there's plenty of sadness on it, too.
So your comedy, like, I'm kind of trying to figure it out. So you've got
to create a unified theory of my work.
I am trying to. I'm trying
it's
to do
very
that.
Very difficult. People are writing PhDs on this subject. So
as well, they should. But you've got the serious side with the music, and then the not so serious side with the music, and the parody side with the music, and then the full on comedy, and then the kind of
You're creating a scale. You're creating some kind of scale. I like it with your hands. You're showing like a fire, like when it's forest fire season, like we're in yellow.
You go to the
territory.
Hospital and you have an operation.
Yeah, the pain scale.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're at a 5 or 6 right now.
Right.
I think. So the surrealism part of it, that part of the comedy,
mm-hmm.
like how did you come by that as like that's your in?
Well, you know, Eric and I went to film school together. You know, we had all the traditional influences in our growing up with Monty Python and Saturday Night Live and, you know, Albert Brooks for me, Andy Kaufman, all that stuff we just loved. And we would, you know, we're fans of that stuff, but we're also trying to do our own thing. And just we've always just done stuff to make each other laugh, you know, and that luckily has translated into a career. But it was never like too analytical about what we were doing. But it's still to this day, like we text each other dumb ideas that are dumb, dumb things, but it's the commitment to then take that line that we've written and see it through totally. The commitment to see it through is, I think, where the good stuff comes in.
Reminds me a little bit of Bob Odenkirk's old stuff.
Yes. I mean, he was the guy that sort of discovered us. We have a great lineage with and a great relationship with him still.
But, well, he's another guy who's gone into a different direction, into the serious
thing. See? We can do it. Us funny people. I mean, Steve Martin has his music career. You know. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is all of us musicians or comedy people or actors, whatever, we always start as like teenagers who want to make stuff. And some of us start playing guitar. Some of us act in plays. Some of us do puppet shows. And then one thing clicks and you kind of follow that and work really hard on it. But we get labeled something and people expect it. But we all like to do all kinds of things. Some of us.
Well, how should I label you?
Multi-hyphenate.
Okay. Tim Heidecker is a multi-hyphenate. You can hear his latest album, What the Broken Hearted Do, on Spotify or Apple Music. Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Coffee's gone cold. The fridge is gone empty. Not sure what I'm staying here for. Living is hard, it sure ain't easy. I don't know what I'm waking up for anymore.
Coming up, Cool of Cool and the Gang is here to help us celebrate Memorial Day next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Bram. You have never not heard that song. Chances are you are grooving to it right this very second. You've heard it at a wedding, no doubt, a graduation, a campaign rally, wherever you have heard that song a million times. Well, Cool and the Gang's anthem turns 40 this summer, and we're going to celebrate, yeah, I said that, with band leader and co-founder Robert Cool Bell. Welcome to the show, Cool.
How are you doing, Madeline?
I am doing great. That song never gets old. It's just such a great song. And when your group wrote that, you wanted it to be an anthem, right?
Well, my brother came up with the idea. We were out in L.A., and we had just won 2 American Music Awards for Ladies' Night. At the end of Ladies' Night, we speak about this is your night celebrating. And he played the song for us, and it had that kind of down-home groove to it, you know, like the down south, sitting on the porch in your grandmother's rocking chair, and then you say, Yahoo! How you feeling today?
Anyway. Who came up with that part? Yahoo! Did that just come out spontaneously, or was it written?
No. When we're in the studio, we just let it all come out, you know, and one of the guys said, that, hey, we could put that in a song.
Did you have any idea that it would become such a huge hit?
No, we didn't. Actually, I mean, Ladies' Night was huge, and it was the beginning of audition to the band adding a lead singer. Mm-hmm. The name is James J.T. Taylor. Ladies' Night was the first song he did with us. Mm. When we did Celebration, and it was Too Hot, and all the other songs that was on that album, Celebration just took off.
Let's just hear a little clip from Ladies' Night, because now, well, now I need to hear it.
Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night, and the feeling's right. Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night, oh, what a night.
Oh, what a night.
Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night, and the feeling's right. Oh, yes, it's Ladies' Night, oh, what a night.
It just has that, I mean, it really has also a disco vibe to it. So this is 1979, right, that this was released?
Yes, that was during the time of Studio 54. And my wife and I, we used to hang out in New York. And then on the weekends, there was always a ladies' night. So I said, wow, that's a great idea. Let me take that back to the guys. Because we were just putting the album together. I said, hey, I got a perfect song for this album. They said, oh, what? I said, ladies' night, man. That's how it happened.
So you grew up in New Jersey, right, with the other guys in the band?
Yes.
When did you start making music together?
Well, we started back in 1964. My brother and I We were born in Youngstown, Ohio. We came to Jersey City in 1960, and we formed the first group in 1964.
And how old were you then?
14.
You were just 14?
Yes, I was a young guy. We all were young. And we called ourselves the Jazzy Acts. And then we changed the name to the Soul Town Band, because Jersey City was trying to be like Motown. And we would have to learn these songs from the Motown hits, because a lot of these guys in the group that was a part of Soul Town was singing Motown hits. And one of the masters of ceremony for Soul Town came up with this idea, and he had a picture of the a big block of ice and fire on top and melting the ice. He said, "How you guys like that?" I said, "Oh, yeah, well, hey, we don't have a name right now. Just call us the Soul Town Band." So we became Cool in the Flames.
Cool in the Flames?
Cool in the Flames. That's what he had in the window. That didn't work because you had James Brown in the Famous Flames.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't want to have any problems with the Godfather. So we said, well, hey, we'll just change the name of the gang. The music is, you know, R&B, funk. So that's how we became Cool in the Gang.
So how did you become Cool?
Well, Cool was a nickname. When I left Youngstown, Ohio, guys in the neighborhood had nicknames. Here's old country boy around New York, Newark, and those big cities. So I had to try to fit in. I think being cool might work.
And cool with a K, not with a C.
With a K, right.
Cool with a K. In that time period, in the early 70s, there were these other big soul bands coming up too, Earth, Wind & Fire and the Commodores. What was your relationship like with those other acts?
The Commodores, excuse me, we used to work with them up in Harlem. We started doing some shows together with the Commodores around New York. And then Earth, Wind & Fire, we worked with them in their earlier years. They were more West Coast, of course, and places like Maverick Flats and some of those early clubs out there. And then you had Parliament Funkadelics, you had George Clinton, you had Ohio Players, you had, you know, the Barcades. It was a whole lot of us out there.
And a lot of you guys would play on Soul Train.
Yes.
I want to play a clip of tape from 1974.
And as they join us again, featuring Mr. Donald Boyce on the vocals, let's see if we've got enough steam left to do that jungle boogie with Cool Like That.
That's another good one. So many hits, Cool. So many hits. So you had a lot of exposure on Soul Train and American Bandstand back in those days. How did things change in the 80s with MTV?
Well, MTV took a little while for us to get on MTV, but MTV was different. You're talking video, a whole different approach to the music thing, you know?
Yeah.
Soul Train and Bandstand, you actually doing your thing. Videos were videos. That's a whole nother part of the industry at that time. But MTV was very strong, very powerful at making things happen.
But you got more play on like Soul Train and shows like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Soul Train and American Bandstand and the one with Wolfman Jack.
There was a few shows out there during that time. I guess I'm wondering, since these songs are played so often, I just heard Celebration at Joe Biden's celebration after he won South Carolina. Do you get royalties every time that song's played, or any of your songs?
Well, I mean, Warner Chappell's a publisher, so I'm quite sure they was tracking. I was actually in Saudi Arabia when that happened.
So you heard about it. You heard that Joe Biden used your song at his campaign event.
I'm hearing about it from you.
Oh, just now. Okay. Well, guess what? I mean, how do you feel about that, your songs being used in a political setting?
We're very happy about Celebration. I mean, we're talking about 40 years of Celebration, and About a year ago, maybe a year and a half, they played Celebration at the space station where the astronauts got up.
Oh,
they
wow.
was floating around celebrating good times. Come on.
That must have felt really great.
That felt very good. I said, wow, we're in space.
Well, does it feel a little different when a politician uses it and maybe a politician you don't support?
That's a hard one to control because of the song Celebration.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time, I think it was Bush and Gore,
mm-hmm.
and we got a call from the Democrats, we got a call from the Republicans to play for the inauguration.
Did you say yes to both of them or no to both of them?
We just waited to see what was going to happen.
Well, so did we all. And boy, did we wait. And your son is also in the business, right?
Yes, he's a writer, rapper. His name is, he goes by the name of Prince Hakeem. He's a DJ also, so I got a chance to go out and check him out, and he's pretty much on it because he has the knowledge of the music of the 70s and 80s.
Well,
and
he
then
better.
When he raps on Celebration. That's a simple one.
Oh, he does.
He comes out with us. Yeah, he comes out with us, and he does a little rap on Hollywood Swinging and also Celebration. Matter of fact, we did 48 shows with Van Halen about 2 or 3 years ago, and they loved them out there. You know, and David and all those guys. Yeah, we had a great time with the Van Halen.
That is quite a combination, you guys and Van Halen.
It was. But you know what? It worked. Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
I remember David was saying that, hey, in the 70s, we used to play Jungle Boogie and Hollywood Swinging in the clubs when it was first starting out in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that 60% of our audience are ladies. I said, oh. And he said, you guys roll ladies' night. I said, yes. And he said, in the 80s, we had Jump, and you guys had Celebration. I said, yes. He said, let's go out and have a party, cool. Come on, man, let's do it. And that's how it happened.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And he was right, because when we played ladies' night, you talk about, 10, 20,000 people, those ladies got up. And whoever was with them, he said, you better get down on it, because we're going to celebrate.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That is Robert Cool Bell, co-founder of Cool and the Gang.
Oh, what's he going to do? You want to get down?
Well, that's it for our special musical edition of Press Play here on KCRW. I hope you're having a great day off. Even if you're not traveling or going outside your house, I'm Madeline Brand. Stay safe. I'll see you tomorrow.